listening to the radio program about hackerspaces.
Good evening and welcome to the March edition of the Hacktivism Hour. In the studio we have first of all our sound technician GMC and our resident hacker Brainsmoke. We also have a esteemed studio guest, it's Amelia Andersdotter, MEP-elect for the Pirate Party. And on our virtual panel we have Kasia Smiljevic from Panopticon Foundation Poland. She's in Warsaw right now. Stefan Marsiska, who's a hacker from the hackerspace in Budapest. All welcome to the show. And my name is Walter, but first some music.
El pollo que comemos está cargado de hormonas femeninas. Por eso los hombres cuando comen este pollo tienen desviaciones en su ser como hombre.
Thank you for trying this demo. Thank you. Thank you for trying. Thank you for trying.
Okay, you were listening to DJ Trichinosis from Spain with the song Demo from his album Pig Brother. We thought it was a suitable song for this evening, so shortly after Dutch Big Brother Awards. The first subject I'd like to kick off with the panel is the new edition of the Free Culture Forum Barcelona Declaration. And, well, Steph, you were there. What's new in it?
The new forum, or the forum last year, tried to come up with some solutions about how to survive, how to make a living creating free culture, creating free software. And there was quite a lot of discussions going on. And in the end, after about 4 months of work, they produced, or we produced, a document and a short declaration about all this, which I think everyone should read and consider to make it as a business model for a living.
But why should we, as in the people from the internet, be the ones telling the other people what business models they should use?
It's a prescription of models that seem to work in some cases. There are some business models listed that seem to be successful, and as such, they are a good model for anyone else to follow, I think. It's more like a recommendation, I think.
And what is the target audience?
Basically, I think any creator, any artist, any software producer, basically anyone.
Okay. Amelia, you were also there, I suppose.
I was. I'm not like, as far as I got it from the forum, many of the people who were actually there do their work more or less not for profit. And the business models that were discussed were also things like voluntary work. Free software is usually written by volunteers, or public funding, work on the side, that kind of thing. And granted, that's a great mode. We also discussed what sharing licenses or kind of flat rates. Mostly not for profit. I mean, it's good with public funding and all, but I don't know if I want to call it a business model. It's not like we were really discussing any market solutions. And from a policy side as well, we had, on the one hand, like sharing licenses, people who promoted that vigorously, and people who were opposing it also vigorously. And not really like any conclusion was made around that. Not from a policy perspective, that seemed to be the only policy discussion going on. All the rest of it was how to do voluntary work sustainably.
So, if I understand you correctly, there was no choice between market and public solutions.
The market solutions that were presented were more like public solutions. And I think it goes very well along with the kind of free culture, free software as well. They're essentially social projects, right? They're something people do to share and to collaborate. They're not really something that people do to create a free market based on competition and capital accumulation.
I would say that the free software world is a pretty capitalistic part of the world. It's mostly funded by corporations.
Maybe if you go to the open source community, you can find some capitalism, but I wouldn't call, for instance, Richard Stallman any avid promoter of the capitalistic society or the capitalistic business model as such.
He's a bit of an old school Marxist, but he fits in rather well into the free market world.
Well, he certainly fits in the free software culture.
Okay, let's just assume that he fits in some parts of the world. Steph, what is, in your opinion, the most contentious part of it, apart from the flat rate solution, which has been proposed by some and has been put into document with various restrictions?
Basically, there are different business models also, or sustainable models listed that are based on microfinancing, on Flatter, and what's it called, this where you can set up a project, and if it reaches a goal, then Kickstarter, yes. And such such solutions were proposed, and I think this is quite a good list for trying to make a living out of creation.
No, but I disagree. Now, you look at what Flatter.com has actually been used for. It's mostly hacker blogs or various projects driven by hackers. It's not really... that's not bad. It's not like this is an unimportant group of cultural workers or like creators of stuff, but it's not the whole of culture or artistry in society. And I get the same thing like with Kickstarter. If you look at the projects that have actually been successful at Kickstarter, it's something like Diaspora, the Freedom Box Foundation, but they were already given lots of attention in media. So what you're basically saying is that projects that are promoted by strong people are the projects that should survive, and projects that may be innovative but not supported by somebody like Eben Moglen deserve to die or not be financed.
Survival of the fittest, very capitalistic.
It's not survival. It's not survival of the fittest. It's survival of the person who gets the most popular supporter.
Okay, Kasia, to what extent is that part of the Polish public discussion? New funding models.
Well, I'm afraid we are still far beyond, far behind that discussion in Poland. Personally, I'm trying to analyze these models because my foundation is working on a think tank project, and the part of this project is devoted to IP, the impact of IP rights on fundamental freedoms. So we are discussing this internally, but externally, I mean, in the public debate, there is no response whatsoever, and we are being seen as a bunch of freaks who are talking about irrelevant issues as far as this is concerned. Well, but, well, I hope it's going to change. And talking about Flatter, we as foundation are trying to apply this to the Polish market and see whether people will start clicking and giving us some Flatter money. So we might be the first ones not from non-hacking communities testing this in Poland, hopefully successfully.
Well, I hope so as well. I find this interesting. I thought Panopticon was mostly about privacy issues. What kind of project is this you're working on?
Well, I mean, we work on surveillance, as our name might suggest to some. You can compare what we do to what EFF does or Epic does. So it's both freedom of expression and privacy with the focus on electronic communications, but not only. And the project I mentioned is, well, it's almost half of our activity at the moment. We are trying to think of internet regulation both in Poland and in the EU and think of possible solutions to make fundamental freedoms work online. We work on five different topical areas, and one of them is IP.
Okay, well, great to hear that.
Well, the interesting part of this is that we are trying to talk to politicians and business, and it sort of works. I mean, we do meet these guys. I will hold a meeting in April, like a roundtable meeting to discuss our observations with this group. So in this way, I guess we are doing something interesting in Poland.
Yeah, but are you already managing to attract some Polish media attention for this?
Well, yes, we do a lot of campaigning. I mean, this project is two-tiered project. On one hand, it's analyzing, thinking, and proposing solutions, meaning writing stuff that nobody will read. But on the other hand, it's campaigning. We do most of the campaigning that you know from EDRI network, from EU-wide campaigns. I'm talking about internet blocking, about data retention, things like ACTA. And these things, they do get a lot of media response.
Okay, well, talking about internet blocking...
yes.
I heard it's Hack Your MEP Week, isn't it?
Well, we are trying to be kind with them and be sometimes the hugging people, not only the teasing people. Talking seriously, there was interesting turn in the European Parliament. Probably most of the people would know that on 14 February, interesting compromise has been achieved with regard to blocking. MEPs from Libe voted the way we wanted them to vote, we meaning activists from across the EU.
Can you explain a bit about the compromise which got voted for in the Libe committee? The Libe committee, by the way, for those who don't know, it's about the liberties and civil rights subcommittee of the European Parliament. But Kasia, do carry on, please.
Sure. From those who will not know that there was, the whole process started with the proposal from the European Commission. Commission thought of introducing blocking as one of the measures to help fighting dissemination of child porn, so-called child porn, in the internet. And what they wanted to do was to introduce a very vague obligation for member states to block whenever it's not possible or it's unduly difficult to remove the content. But the way these provisions were drafted in the directive was so bad that you could actually predict that all member states will start blocking whenever they want, because it was so vague and open. Plus, there was no mention of international cooperation on removing the content and pursuing criminals. There was a mention of self-regulatory measures. So there were a few problems with these provisions. And at the beginning, we thought that it's lost game from the beginning. I mean, nobody would listen to us. It was all sorted. There was compromise actually almost achieved. But then the big campaign started around 1 month ago. People were calling MPs, writing. It was really big, really energetic. And it turned out to be really successful because the Libe committee, subcommittee, which is very important for that particular proposal, changed their turn completely, went against the initial proposal, and introduced good changes. The good changes are mostly that the blocking will be not mandatory, but only voluntary for member states whenever they decide. And if they decide to block, they will have to prove a lot of things. I mean, there are many safeguards in the directive that will prevent blocking from happening just because the politicians want it. In the first place, they will have to prove that they did everything to remove the content, but also they will have to prove that they did everything to increase international cooperation to remove the content, which is a big thing. And they removed any reference to self-regulation, so it might help prevent self-regulatory measures.
Well, it actually has, because the Dutch ISPs have already announced that they will drop their plan for self-regulatory voluntary blocking.
Because they said it's not working, didn't they?
Yes, they said it's just not working. Well, we would end up with a blacklist of two or three entries, and that's probably not the point of it all. It's probably very important to hack your MEP, I think, because I already got some shouting emails on the Edry board list from people who thought we were horrible persons for not being in favor of blocking to save the children.
Of course, you know, they are all pro-pedophilia and they will now be deemed as pedophiles themselves, probably. So we really need to mobilize.
Can I add something?
Sure.
No country that has any filter for child pornography has ever been able to track down child pornography rings. But if you look at the US and Spain that don't have internet filtering, they manage to take down child pornography rings all the time. So... that's an interesting fact that everyone should keep in mind.
And most of the countries who did have filters or still have filters have a very untransparent process for putting stuff in those filters. I think it's time for some music. I was thinking about some nice 8-bit bleeps from Minirock, a German 8-bit artist, and then the song Bitter Bleeps from his album Miniland.
That's nice. You should have mentioned that before you announced it, probably.
I'm sorry,
I had to look for it. And oh, here it is.
Well, hello, back again. Well, we briefly mentioned the Big Brother Awards. Kasia, you're going to organize the Polish Big Brother Awards. When will those be? Okay, we lost Kasia, thanks to Skype. evil Skype.
Evil technology.
Shall I just put on some more music and until we sort out the Skype issues?
Well, we've got Steph back at least.
Okay, we got Steph back. Hello, Steph.
Yeah, hi, back. Good to hear you again.
Okay, thanks. I was just asking...
What's up to? What was up in the time when I was not playing?
We played some music.
Okay.
I've got a brilliant piece of news, by the way. After all these pieces of three strikes and you're out in France and in England, etc., the Belgians have chipped in as well, even without having a government, and they're now proposing a four strikes and you're out law. What do you think of that stuff?
I was shocked that even without having a government, they are able to pass such a law. But they call it only, I think, some kind of amendment or some change to a law, which I think is just legal mumbo-jumbo. But you're better with that, I guess.
You're a hacker. You call everything legal mumbo-jumbo. So.
Oh, yes. I think people are quite adept at twisting words and putting new meanings in that. It's called newspeak. And people don't care so much. I think this is more psychologic than also legal.
But anyway, I hope the Belgians may get rid of this, although I don't quite trust them to have me. Another issue we might discuss is this complete avalanche of new intellectual property initiatives in the EU. I've heard that the proposal to extend the performing rights from 50 to 70 years got unstuck in the Council of Ministers. Amelia, do you have some thoughts on that?
Well, it's not really surprising, though, is it? Like, performance rights and copyrights are quite similar, and therefore they should be protected the same. It's, I guess, the rationale behind this.
Are you trolling me, or are you serious?
If I was making decisions about copyright with the viewpoint that all rights granted to different actors in the creative industry should be equal, I would definitely not harmonize downwards. I would harmonize upwards, because this is the way intellectual property rights maximalism works.
Yes, indeed. But we didn't get any performance rights until the 80s, I think.
No, the 1930s or 1952 was the signing of the Rome Convention, right?
Yeah, but the Dutch were always a bit slow in implementing stuff, so may have taken a bit longer.
Yeah, but it was there. The only country that I know of that's actually harmonized downwards in the European Union is Spain. They used to have, for copyrights, lifetime plus 80 years. And then after 1987, they lowered it to lifetime plus 70 years in coherence with all the other European member states. But for works made before 1987, the old rules still apply. So there's quite a lot of works that are entering into public domain in all of Europe now that aren't entering into public domain in Spain, which was criticized, obviously, by the public domain actors in Spain some month ago or so.
But apparently it's getting unstuck. Steph, since Hungary is now the chairing the European Union, at least in the Council of Ministers, what do you expect the chances are that they will want to really push this as a Hungarian success?
Sorry, can you repeat the question? Skype did some
funky stuff.
Interference. Yeah. Yes.
I was wondering, given the Hungarian presidency of the Council of Ministers, what the likelihood is of them really pushing this forward during their term?
To be honest, I think they are not quite independent in this. I think there's quite some pressure on them to follow these actions anyway. I think there's a lot of pressure coming from I think other European states. So this is inevitable, I think.
And
Hungary is acting, I think, quite weakly on this. It's, and anyway, if you, for example, consider the Lakhvata Tudunet political memory tool, how where you have a comparison of other countries and groups and members of parliament, how they voted on different issues that are important to Lakhvata Tudunet, then you can see on this list that by far Hungary is the lowest. I think Detroit is on the 27th place, and the 26th is like 10% higher. So I think this is quite unexpected.
Okay. Well, we're getting back to IP a bit later on, but since we got Kasia back, I think we should move back to the Big Brother Awards thing. Kasia, you'll be organizing the Polish Big Brother Awards in the coming year, aren't you?
Well, hopefully we will. It needs a lot of organization and a lot of money that we don't have yet. But, well, we met someone that might be willing to sponsor it, someone meaning one foundation that. So that makes it more realistic. When I hear stories from other member states, what I know by now is that we really need a big thing. Otherwise, it's pointless. I mean, the whole idea of organizing Big Brother Awards in a country like Poland is to really get to the mainstream. This is the main challenge we have with privacy issues. They are completely out of focus normally. And if we manage to get some show and some media attention and some famous, unfortunately, some celebrities to come and talk with us, that might help a lot in awareness rising.
Don't you have any juicy privacy disasters in Poland?
Oh, well, plenty. Plenty, but they are juicy. They seem most juicy to us. Well, okay, it's not that bad. Sometimes we do get these things to the media, as I said, about, for example, data retention. We had very big news with data retention when we discovered the actual numbers for Poland. And we discovered that Poland is almost a leader in terms of the number of requests that Secret
You're
Services...
You're still way behind the Netherlands.
I know. But at that point, we were not sure, because at that point, we didn't have the data from the Netherlands. So we actually thought we are the leaders with 1 million requests per year. But anyway, it was really on the first pages of all newspapers. And soon after, we discovered that journalists were investigated. We're under surveillance using, among others, data retention law. And that became another big news. So things like that work with imagination of the public, but it's in general difficult.
So, but will this be your first time, or have you organized this before?
No, never before. I heard about the idea, and well, Panopticon was created 2 years ago, not even. So the moment we came to existence and I discovered that the Big Brother Awards happen in other countries, I wanted to do it, but it really needs a lot of organizing power behind to work well.
Yeah, but don't be too put off by the difficulties.
The Dutch ones.
Or the Dutch ones. Well, I think the German and the Austrian and the Belgian ones are interesting
how,
too.
How was the Dutch one? I assume that you must have been there, right?
I was there, and right in front of me is Brainsmoke, who wrote a ticketing system for the Big Brother Award. It was, I think it was completely sold out. How many tickets were sold, Brain?
Well, actually, I just imported the list of tickets, so I can't give you an exact number, but we were sold out, yeah.
But how, in what, which ballpark figure?
Yeah, hundreds of tickets.
A few hundred, I think.
Yeah, 300, wow. If I recall correctly. Yeah.
Well, so you get money for that? I mean, you actually get people to pay?
They were first time they were charging. They were not charging 9 euros, and they were sold out. So, but in previous years, I think this is the fourth or the fifth time Bits of Freedom organized this.
And you got free drinks in return for the...
Yeah.
I think it was because it was a great success, and tickets were sold because otherwise too many people would have shown up and people would have been disappointed, and because they traveled all the way to Amsterdam. And so
how did you get to this point that it becomes so popular and people really want to go there? what do you think? What makes it so popular?
I think it's just having repeated examples of juicy stuff, and I think an opportunity for you would actually be those journalists who are being investigated that would give you direct access to the media for coverage of an event like this. And I mean, in Amsterdam last night, the Dutch national television was there, but also ZDF, so the German television had a camera crew over there, and the various awards were headline news, or not really front page news, but were mentioned all the major newspaper today, including the double whammy for Translink Systems, the company running the so-called OV chip card in the Netherlands, which is a public transport card, it's a contactless RFID card. And they got both an award from the jury and the publicity, the public voted award. And the funny bit was their director actually came on stage defending this chip card and telling us there was nothing wrong with it. And he was genuinely affronted by this. And
he was convinced it was a great product, actually. Yeah.
We should be proud. We should be proud that the Netherlands had such a nice, complex card, and there was no issue about privacy whatsoever.
Interestingly enough, that it was the very first campaign we did in Poland, as Panopticon was against chip cards in Warsaw, and it was pretty successful. I mean, it really appealed to the public, and if we did organize Big Brother Awards at that time, that would be our candidate for winning. But coming back to Netherlands, do you think that this is a change? This is a sign of the change in the society. The society becomes more aware, more interested in privacy.
Yeah. Well, in this, I don't think this will change very much in the short term. But it is absolutely the case that a few years ago there was a lot less attention for privacy issues than there is now. It's really becoming a mainstream issue now. And
congratulations.
Well, yeah, congratulations for Bits of Freedom, mainly for putting such a great emphasis, plus a few other privacy groups in the Netherlands.
I would be interested in knowing what the audience consisted of. I mean, I saw a lot of my friends that I know from the hacktivism scene, so to speak. But also a lot of people I had never seen before. So,
well, there was lots of the media company Twitterati in crowd from Amsterdam as well. And in a sense, it's a bit of an elitist affair, though, being at the Big Brother Awards. And one of the things I've really liked about it, that Bits of Freedom managed to get some famous faces on stage. For example, some famous television presenters to present the award. So,
that's what I mean about Poland. I mean, without things like that, we can't really get to the numbers that you are mentioning. Our elite, if you call it like that, is maybe tens of people, but never hundreds of people.
And at the same time, they got a Playboy model involved in promoting the event. So, so both high, and they had several university professors presenting awards as well. So it was, well, pretty wide spectrum, culturally speaking, in that respect. So maybe you should get a Playboy model
that might work. That might work.
Poland has lots of pretty women, though, doesn't it?
Okay.
Well, that's what foreigners say.
let's get back to serious issues.
Oh, this is serious. Come on.
It is very serious, but
women are very serious.
We just had International Women's Day, and I appreciate the modesty of the ladies that they accept one day of the 365 days of the year. enough about political incorrect stuff. I thought it was also worth talking about the Swift stuff. It's just popping up again.
This is politically incorrect stuff.
Swift is also very politically incorrect as far as I am concerned. But,
me too.
Because apparently the safeguards imposed on Swift are more or less ignored in practice.
Well, that's what people might expect when they were created, and I guess we criticized it back then, that it's not guaranteed enough. I mean, because most of the systems are based on internal supervision and not external supervision of some independent authorities, one might expect that this is going to be the end, yes.
But if I understand the newspapers correctly, Europol has been selling our data to the Americans all the time.
Well, yes, one might summarize it like that. I don't know how much people know about this agreement, but in most broad terms, it's about transferring financial data to the US. I mean, EU gives a lot of financial data to the US because of the war on terror and the other high security needs. In practice, it gives it in bulk for any security-related needs. So this is the main thing we keep criticizing, saying that we do give them a lot of data about all our citizens, not really knowing how this data is used. And the major point of the whole renegotiating of the agreement and the whole battle was about making it more precise and making it more within what we see as data protection rules. But apparently it's not going to work so easily.
So if I understand you correctly, every bank transaction is being given to the Americans if they ask for it?
No. There is something like a database created of all banking transactions, and before renegotiating of this agreement, it was like that the Americans would receive that database in bulk. So in a sense, they have direct access to all financial data without asking. And after the negotiations and the hopes for getting things better, it was supposed to be a different way, that they do not get everything in bulk. They need to issue requests, and then it goes through Europol, through some form of authorization, and only then they receive data that they requested. But from what you say now, and from the newspapers say, seem that it's not working properly.
Well, as far as I remember, SWIFT is a private entity based in the United States, and
no,
because
it's a Belgian private
entity.
Yeah,
yes,
well, it's also based in the United States, and if it has offices in the United States, obviously it will have the rights to transfer its data to its subsidiaries or whatever. And the agreement is there to basically limit SWIFT's freedoms to do so indiscriminatorily.
Not quite. Under the Privacy Directive, they're not supposed to export data anyway, but they did.
Well, the story I recall about SWIFT itself is that they were actually the good people, the good guys in this story. They wanted, it started from that company defying US requests. At the beginning, is exactly as Amelia said, SWIFT would give all the data to the US whenever asked, but at some point they realized it's going too far, and it was their idea to move or create a subsidiary of SWIFT in Europe in order to prevent that from happening. And that was actually the very fact that triggered the whole agreement between EU and US, because before it was
slightly
needed.
Different. SWIFT was cooperating because they had a data center in Europe and one in the United States. It was mirroring all the transactions. After the European Parliament found out and cried full about this, especially Sophie Intveld should be commended for her role in that, then SWIFT split their operation and had two data centers in Europe and two on the North American continent. And then the Americans said, well, we can't get to this data in the United States anymore. Can we get a formal way to negotiate this? But we're getting too much into the technicalities. I think it's time for some music. And since our data is apparently all over the world, upcoming song is...
Relax.
It's All Over the World by Stain Branding, and they're French, from the album All Over the World.
Design Branding Live.
Welcome back again. Moving back from privacy to digital signatures. Steph, did you know there's a European Commission consultation about digital signatures going on?
No. What does that encompass?
Digital signatures is about PKI. So asymmetric cryptography being used for certificates such as SSL.
Okay.
And they're launching a consultation on how those...
What regulation does that need?
It's part of the e-commerce directive, if I'm not completely mistaken. But maybe Amelia can correct me on that.
It's not. I think it's the e-privacy directive, the one that was never properly applied to the e-commerce directive because it was a set of stupid rules that nobody could use.
Well, the Dutch implemented the directive.
Well, it is, but if nobody can use it, like, nobody can do anything useful with it, just like, meh.
Certificates are quite extensively used right now.
Well, certificate, yes, but I think they're more kind of a self-regulation. They don't actually stem from the e-privacy directive. I think you had them even before the e-privacy directive, and the e-privacy directive added a set of nonsensical rules on top of that, that if anything destroyed business opportunities that could have otherwise been quite secure.
It got assigned a formal status, a digital signature.
Yes, but it wasn't used anywhere. It's not used anywhere.
It is.
No.
In Hungary, some legal professions use digital signatures. Sure, they are obliged to only use that exclusively to communicate with the state, as far as I know. But this is quite a limited set of society, I guess. So maybe you're right that this needs to, I don't know how to regulate that to make it acceptable for the whole society, though.
What I find interesting about this consultation is the current system doesn't really allow for peer-to-peer schemes such as CA Search to be recognized as legally valid digital signatures. It's a very hierarchical model.
The classical PGP web of trust is the best web of trust that you can come up with. The problem is it's not decentralized, and probably if there's anywhere somewhere some talk about fraud detection, then it's probably violating privacy, because if it's fraud detection, then they can reverse the signature or somehow. I don't know. But the decentralized nature is key here, I think, and that's a pity.
It's indeed funny because the PGP-like web of trust is, I'm getting told by hackers like you all the time, that's the safest way, but it's not legally recognized, and the hierarchical model is less safe apparently, but is recognized.
Yet every time we sign keys, we always show us also our IDs. This is quite common. So as we build the web of trust for us, this is really a strong web of trust, as we really can show, require also IDs to be shown if we really sign the key, because it's such a strong bond. But yes, legally it's not recognized. You're right.
But Steph, if I would want to get this consultation answered by a bunch of hackers, where should I start?
I think here, and I guess some mailing lists.
Such as?
I think I like this idea. I don't know.
Well, there's a couple, like the Hackerspace is mailing list. There's smart people on there. I would imagine the people who are doing the hour after this, the Telecomics crew, would also have quite a keen ideas on this.
Yeah, I should, by the way, mention that Telecomics will be doing an hour after us. That should have been mentioned before. And what more about Telecomics? GPG?
Sorry?
The GPG guys, perhaps?
Yeah. Although I still have my doubts with the way we sign these GPG keys. I mean, I don't know how all the legal identifications look all over the world. So I'm pretty easily to be led to believe that you actually have a valid Bulgarian ID, because I would have no clue what a valid Bulgarian ID would look like.
But a valid Bulgarian ID has an RFID chip, which is digitally signed by the Bulgarian government.
Right, right.
So at the end of the day, this peer-to-peer scheme is dependent on government keys.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't care about these government keys. I know you. I know who you are. I have met you. If we exchange keys, I have in my mind a person who belongs to this key. I don't care what his ID is. I know that's you and that we talked. And see, that's something different than seeing an ID and, okay, so he's this person. For me, that's maybe useless. But
I think this is also key for solving this whole debate. Maybe it's simply enough then that if it's legally binding, if two people agree that their key signing automatically means that they accept the other's digital signature in an official and legal binding way as well.
If two persons would agree that, well, this is the scheme, it is legally binding. This scheme is being cooked up in case people haven't met before to allow internet commerce or e-commerce. And that's why I thought it was in the e-commerce directive, but Emilia is right, it was not in there, I think, but it was one of the earlier directives on distant sales over the internet or something like that. But it's this whole idea of having a legally recognized digital key is mainly intended for people who have never met before, may even never meet, and just to allow them to trust them each other enough to have some commerce at a distance together.
And that's the core concept here, right? Trust. I mean, yep. It's about trust. And at the end, I don't trust those guys doing the website certificates. They just accept credit cards and give out certificates.
You know that. You're a hacker.
Yeah.
I'm a stupid lawyer. I trust them.
You do? Okay. You should know. You should know better, but I mean, if the government takes over this role, it comes down to, do I trust my government to make a correct judgment on who to trust and not?
Well, right now it's the government overseeing those certificate authorities.
Okay.
At least that's how it's been done in the Netherlands. I don't know how it is in Sweden, Poland, or Hungary. How is it done in Sweden, Emilia? Do you know that?
I have absolutely no clue.
Okay, Kasia. Thank you.
Well, talking about digital signatures, we do not. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
We have an issue with upcoming revision of our national ID cards policy. Our state is trying to combine the two, digital signatures with the standard ID issued to all the citizens. And, well, your discussion can be applied to our problems, because what the government is trying to do, they are trying to create a sort of monopoly designed by one specific company. It will probably be ABM, and there is a lot of mess around that, starting from technology applied that is being criticized to the way it's being managed. I mean, the public procurement and so on. So, yes, well, we have issues.
But the public procurement in this is like a completely different issue. Which company you develop the technology is not actually the same as if the system as such is okay or not. Because the problem with...
Sure, that's what I said. It's two different issues, yes.
Well, there's a third issue with public procurement. In the Netherlands, in public procurement, you're more or less forced to use digital signatures. in case you write in with a digital offer for services to the government. Yes. And in that area, they're rather widely used. And by the way, talking about public procurement, there's a consultation on public procurement going on.
Oh, no.
Yes, there is. And it even
there's consultation on everything.
Yes, there's consultations on everything going on.
Can I just come back a little bit for the, to the digital signatures?
Yes, please do, Steph.
Because in Hungary, we also have the same discussion going on now. They want to create some digital identification, which also includes possibly some digital signatures. And yes, we are also preparing some action. But the interesting thing with the digital signature is that the European directive mandates one market. That means that if you have a digital signature from Slovakian certificate authority, that should be accepted also in the Netherlands or in any other country of the EU.
Which country has the lousiest process for overseeing and giving out certificates?
The interesting thing for this is the Slovakian guys, there's one hackerspace called Progress Bar. I think one of the guys, or maybe, I don't know, maybe it's the Prague, I'm not sure. They wanted to do this and they wanted to collect different digital signatures from all over Europe and try to sign and make legal contracts across the European Union with these signatures. So if anyone has some something to contribute to that, I think the guy is called Louis, and maybe you can contact me, and then I forward that.
Maybe we should talk about it afterwards, because we are also running out of time, more or less. And I should mention again that people should keep on listening to the stream, because after us, Telecomlogic will be doing lots of stuff, including digital love. I have no idea what it's about, but we'll hear about it later.
Interesting.
Yes.
Maybe we should stay too.
We'll be wrapping up with our final song. It's called Echoes of Signal by some French DJ Bertie Cox from his album The Signal. And thank you very much for being on the panel, and thank you very much for listening, and probably until next month.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye. Bye. Thanks. Thank you.